This is Lecture 11 of the Lecture Cycle Barbara Standard Practical Advice to Teachers given on September 2nd, 1919. I have told you that geography is first introduced during the second of the three stages between the ages of 7 and 14. We can very well begin with it when the children have reached the age of 9, but it must be approached in the right way. Geography must encompass much more in the future than it does now for children up to 14, 15, and older. It is pushed too much into the background these days, treated like the stepchild of education. In geography, the achievements of all the other lessons should meet and flow together in all sorts of ways. And though I have said that mineralogy is all taken up, is not taken up until the third stage, when the children are about 12, It can be woven into geography in a narrative way, combined with direct observation, during the previous stage. It is particularly important in geography that we start with what the children already know about the face of the earth, and about what takes place on the face of the earth. We endeavor to give the children, in an artistic way, a kind of picture of the hills and rivers and other features of their immediate surroundings. We develop with the children an elementary map of the immediate neighborhood where they are growing up and which they therefore know. Between the ages of 9 and 12, children can take in an enormous amount from geography if we go about teaching it the right way. We try to teach them what it means when you change your point of view from being within a neighborhood to seeing it from outside, from the air. We take them through the process of transforming a landscape into a map, at first with the landscape they know. We try to teach them that rivers flow through the district by actually drawing the system of rivers and streams on the map of the neighborhood. We also draw in the hills. It is good to work with colors, making the rivers blue and the hills or mountains brown. Then we add the other things linked to the way people live. We put in all the configurations of the district, drawing the children's attention to them as we go. Here is a part where fruit trees are planted, so we draw in the fruit trees. Then we point out that there are also some parts covered with coniferous trees, so we draw them in too. We show them that another part of the neighborhood is covered with cornfields, and then we include them on our map. There are also meadows to be added. We point out to the children the meadows that can be shown in this drawing. Meadows that cannot be mown, but that provide grass for the cattle, though it is shorter and sparser, are also included in our map. We tell the children that this is pasture land, and so we bring the map to life for the children. From this map, the children gain some sort of overall view of the economic foundations of the neighborhood. We also start pointing out that there are many things like coal and ore inside the hills. We show them the way in which the rivers are used to transport things from one place to another place. We unfold for them much of what is connected with this economic structure of the district. Having made clear the economic foundation provided by the rivers and hills, fields and woods, and so on, insofar as these things can be explained to the children, we next put in the villages or towns of the district we are dealing with. And now we begin to point out why it is that a village appears at a particular place, and the way this is connected with the courses of the streams and rivers, with the hills, and what they might have to offer in their depths. In short, by using the map, we endeavor to awaken in the children some idea of the economic links that exist between the natural formation of the land and the conditions of human life. This leads into giving them a picture of the difference between country life and town life. We take all this as far as the children are able to grasp it, and finally we show how human beings with their industry meet the conditions nature offers them. That is, we begin to show the children that human beings make artificial rivers known as canals, that they build railways. Then we point out how provisions can be transported with the help of the railways, and how people's very situation in life is affected. After working for a while toward an understanding of the economic relationships between natural conditions and the conditions of human life, we can build on the concepts the children have gained and lead them further into the world at large. If we have taken the first steps in the right way, it will not be necessary to be excessively pedantic in this. The pedant would say at this point that the natural way is to begin with the geography of the immediate neighborhood and then spread out concentrically from there. Even this is too pedantic. There is no need to enlarge in this way. When a firm foundation has been laid in understanding the links between nature and humans, we can quite well turn our attention to something else. In the way we turn to something else, however, we should continue as effectively and intensively as possible to develop the theme of the economic links between human beings and their natural environment. Here in our district, for instance, after developing the necessary concepts from familiar stretches of land and helping the children find their bearings in their own neighborhood, we can widen their horizon by telling them about the geography of the Alps. We can extend the map-making already taught by drawing a line showing where the southern Alps meet the Mediterranean Sea. You can also draw the northern part of Italy, the Adriatic Sea, and so on, saying there are great rivers there and drawing in the courses of the rivers. You draw the Rhone, the Rhine, the Inn, and the Danube with their tributaries, and then add the different arms of the Alps. The children will be extraordinarily fascinated when they discover how the rivers separate the different arms. Then, along the blue lines of the rivers, you can draw red lines, imaginary boundaries, for instance, along the Rhone from Lake Geneva back to its source, then along the Rhine, over the top of the Brenner, and so on, dividing the Alps from west to east. You can then say, look, down below I have drawn a red line along the rivers, and at the top I have also drawn a red line. The Alps lying between these red lines are different from those lying above and below them. Now you could bring mineralogy into geography by showing the children a piece of Jura limestone and saying, quote, the mountain ranges above the top red line and those under the lower red line are made of limestone, like this, unquote. For what lies between, you show them a piece of granite, gneiss, and say, that's how you say it, it's G-N-E-I-S-S, quote, the mountains between the red lines are of rock like this, the oldest rock, unquote. The children will be tremendously interested in this alpine massif. You might perhaps also show them a relief map of the area. This gives a more plastic impression of how the river courses divide the Alps into limestone Alps, gneiss, mica, slate, and so on, and of how the whole length of the range is somewhat carved and shows from south to north the differentiation into limestone, granite, limestone, divided by the rivers. Without any pedantic object lessons, you can bring much to this description that will greatly extend the children's range of ideas. Then you go on to describe to the children, you have already prepared for this in your nature lessons, what grows down in the valley, what grows higher up the mountainside, what grows even higher up, and also what does not grow at the summit. You paint a vertical picture of the vegetation. Next you begin to show the children the ways in which human beings establish themselves in a countryside dominated by massive mountains. Help them picture to themselves a really high mountain village and what people must do to live there. Mark it on your map. Then you describe a village in the roads of a valley and a town at the confluence of a river and one of its tributaries. You characterize in this wider context the relationship between the natural configuration of the land and the way humans establish their economic life. Out of the natural surroundings, you build up a picture of human industry, drawing the children's attention to the places where ore and coal can be found and to how settlements are determined by such things. Next, draw for the children a picture of a landscape with no mountains, a flat plain, and treat it in a similar way. Describe the natural configuration, the structure of the ground, and show them that some plants grow on poor soil and others on rich soil. Point out the makeup of the soil in which potatoes grow. You can do this with quite simple means, or wheat, or rye, and so on. You will already have taught them the differences between wheat, rye, and oats. Do not hesitate to teach them things that as yet they can understand only in a general way, and will grasp more clearly in later lessons, when they return to them from another point of view. Until they are 12, introduce them chiefly to economic conditions and relationships, and make these clear. Concentrate more on describing the geography of their own country than on giving them a complete picture of the earth. Let them, however, gain an impression of how vast the ocean is. You started drawing it when you showed where the southern Alps meet the Mediterranean. Draw the seas a blue surface, and draw the outlines of Spain and France, showing that there is an immense ocean to the west. In a way that they can understand, introduce gradually the idea that America also exists. They should have a mental picture of this before they are 12. If you start with this good foundation, you can count on the children having sufficient understanding when they are about 12 for you to proceed more systematically. You will take less time to give them a picture of the earth as a whole by teaching them about the five continents and the oceans, more briefly than has been your method up to now. and describing the economic life of the different continents. You should be able to formulate everything on the foundations you have laid, when you have drawn together in a picture of the whole earth all the knowledge you have given the children about the economic life of humans, and when you have also taught them history in the manner described for about 6 months, you can transfer your attention to the cultural environment made by the people who inhabit the different continents. But do not go into this different sphere until you have made the children's souls somewhat pliant through their first history lessons. You can also speak of the geographical distribution of the characteristics of the different peoples. Do not speak any earlier about the distinctive differences of the various peoples, for only based on the foundation I have described will the children bring their best understanding to this subject. You can speak of the differences between Asiatic, European, and American peoples, and of the differences between Mediterranean and Northern European peoples. Thus you gradually combine geography with history. You will be fulfilling a beautiful task that brings much joy to the children if you do what I have just described, mainly between the ages of 12 and 15. You see that a great deal must be incorporated into teaching geography, so that it can become a kind of summary of everything else we do with the children, and so much can flow together in geography. Toward the end, a wonderful interplay between geography and history will be possible. Because you embrace many subjects in your geography lessons, you will then be able to draw on them for many lessons. This will, of course, tax your imaginative abilities and your inventiveness. When you tell the children that here or there certain things are done, for instance, that the Japanese make their pictures in a particular way, you can then encourage them to do the same, albeit in their much more simple and primitive way. When you are telling the children about the links between agriculture and the way humans live, do not miss the opportunity to give them a clear picture of a plow and a harrow in connection with the geographical picture. Also, have the children imitate some of the things you tell them, perhaps in the form of a little plaything or a piece of artistic work. This will give them skills and will prepare them for taking their places properly in life later on. You could even make little plows and have them cultivate the school garden, or let them cut with small sickles or mow with small scythes. This will establish a good contact with life. For more important than dexterity is the soul contact made between the life of the child and the life of the world. It is a fact that a child who has cut grass with a sickle or mown it with a scythe, a child who has made a furrow with a little plow, will turn into a different person from one who has not done these things. Quite simply, the soul element is changed. Abstract lessons and manual skills are not really a substitute. Paper folding and laying little sticks should be actively avoided, for these things tend to make children unfit for life rather than fit them for it. It is far better to encourage them to do things that really happen in life than to invent things for them to do that do not occur in life. By building up our geography lessons in the way I have described, we acquaint the children in the most natural way with the fact that human life is brought together from many sides in various ways. At the same time, we take care to deal with things that the children are well able to understand. Thus, between ages 9 and 12, we describe economic conditions and external affairs in our geography lessons. From this point, we lead on to an understanding of cultural and spiritual matters pertaining to different peoples. Then, while saving the details for later, we merely hint at what goes on in the rights sphere of the different nations, letting only the very first, most primitive concepts peep through the economic and cultural life. The children do not as yet have a full understanding for matters of the rights sphere, and if they are confronted with these concepts too early in their development, their soul forces will be ruined for the rest of their lives, because such concepts will be so abstract. It is indeed a good idea if you can use the geography lessons to bring unity to all the other subjects. Perhaps the worst thing that can happen to geography is for it to be regimented into a strictly demarcated timetable, which is something we do not want. We arrange the lessons so that each subject can be treated for a longer span of time. When we take children into the school, we work first of all toward teaching them to write. That is, we occupy the morning hours with painting, drawing, and learning to write. Our timetable will not stipulate that the first lesson be writing, the second reading, and so on. We will occupy ourselves with similar subjects for longer stretches at a time. Not until the children can write a little will we move on to reading. Of course, in learning to write, they also learn to read a little, but these two studies can be combined in an even better way. We assign definite periods for the other lessons too, not following one subject with another lesson by lesson, but staying with one subject for quite some time and coming back to other topics only after several weeks. We concentrate our lessons. In this way, we are in a position to teach much more economically than would be the case if we had to waste our time and energy on adhering to some dreadful timetable, teaching a subject in one lesson and then wiping it out in the next by teaching something quite different. You can see, particularly with geography, how you can approach it from all sorts of directions. It is not laid down for you that you have to teach geography from ages 9 to 10. Instead, you are left free to decide when the time is ripe to fit geography in with whatever else you have been doing. This method imposes a great deal of responsibility on you, but without such responsibility, no teaching can be carried out. A curriculum that from the start lays down a schedule and all sorts of other dictums completely eliminates the art of teaching. This must not be. The teacher must be the driving and stimulating force in the whole educational system. What I have just shown you about the way to teach geography is an excellent example that gives you a proper picture of how everything should be done. Geography really can become a great channel into which everything flows and from which a great deal can also be derived. For instance, in the geography lesson you show the children the ways in which limestone mountains differ from granite mountains. Later you can show them a lump of granite and point out that it contains different minerals, including a substance that sparkles. Then you show them a piece of mica and tell them that what they see sparkling in the granite is mica. Next you can show them all the other substances hiding in granite. You show them a piece of quartz and try to unfold the whole mineral world out of a lump of rock. This is another good opportunity for adding a great deal to the children's understanding of the ways in which things that belong together as a whole can be divided into their separate parts. It is far more useful to teach the children about granite first, and then about the constituent minerals, than it is to start with quartz, mica, feldspar, and so on, and then show them that they are all mixed up in granite. Mineralogy is a very good subject for starting with the whole and moving to the parts, for beginning with the way a mountain is constructed and progressing to mineralogy. This method certainly helps the children. With the animal kingdom, you will proceed in the opposite direction, building up from the individual animals. As we have seen in our seminar discussions, the plant kingdom is to be treated as a totality before we look at the particulars. And for the mineral kingdom, nature itself often supplies us with the aggregate from which we can then proceed to the distinct constituents. Again, linking mineralogy with geography, we must not omit a discussion of how all the things of economic value we find in nature are used. Referring to what we have said about the stony structure of the mountains, we discuss all the substances, such as coal, that we have a use for in industry and elsewhere. We depict these things in a simple way, but the starting point is our discussion of the mountains. Nor should we neglect to describe a sawmill when we are dealing with the forest. We start with the forest, move on to a discussion of wood, and come finally to the sawmill. We can do a tremendous amount with our lessons if we do not have to start with a timetable laid down with military precision, but can proceed accordingly, according to what naturally arises out of them. But we must have a good idea of what is required by the children at the different stages of their development, from the time they start school up to the age of 9, from 9 to 12, and from 12 to 15. The end of Lecture 11.